You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on November the 28th, 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Louise Beale. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Egypt's appeal court judges have called a strike in protest over President Mohamed Morsi's move to give himself widespread powers. It comes as protests in Tahrir Square continue, so will it make Morsi back down? From Hugo Chavez to Christina Kirchner, we also look at the rise of the left in Latin America and the reasons it's dominating the region's political landscape.
It started in 1908 with Hugo Chavez's first victory, and then it went on, and it's a massive turn to the left, and it covered practically the whole continent.
We'll speak to American urban theorist and academic Richard Florida, who tells us what determines which cities will do best in the future and which ones won't.
I think so. Cities, number one, have to remain open and porous. The ones that remain open and porous in a great reset, like now, will do better. The ones that close will kill themselves.
We'll also head to France to find out why wine isn't going down quite as smoothly as it used to. In fact, the French have never drunk as little wine as they do now. So lots still to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the headlines from around the world with Jonathan Wheatley.
Switzerland and Denmark have today followed France in backing Palestinian calls for a diplomatic upgrade of its United Nations status to observer state. All members will vote on the issue tomorrow. It's seen as a vital move towards Palestine gaining official recognition as an independent state. Britain plans to abstain in the vote, although its Foreign Secretary William Hague said Britain could support the Palestinian bid for an upgrade if the UK was assured that the Palestinians would return to peace talks and would not pursue Israel through the International Criminal Court.
For us to support a resolution at the UN, it is important that the risks to the peace process are addressed so that the chances of negotiation beginning after it are enhanced rather than diminished. We explain that while there is no question of the United Kingdom voting against the resolution, in order to vote for it, we would need certain assurances or amendments. The first is that the Palestinian Authority should indicate a clear commitment to return immediately to negotiations without preconditions.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has today said it was regarding a deal by the rebel group M23 to withdraw from towns captured last week with caution. The M23 said it has started pulling its troops out of towns captured last week from government forces, following a deal brokered by Uganda. But in the capital Kinshasa, the DRC government spokesman said it could be a decoy by the rebels and it'll wait for confirmation of the withdrawal. London's Mayor Boris Johnson, on a visit to India, has stressed the need for boosting trade ties between India and the European Union, saying it was also important for the UK to foster new relationships with other countries.
I think it's high time that we did a proper thoroughgoing free trade deal between the EU and India. We got rid of the ridiculous tariffs that stop Indian companies penetrating the European market, ridiculous 12%. And symmetrically, I think there are ways, humbly, respectfully, I think there are ways in which India could experiment with more openness.
Since 2003, the investment by the EU in India has tripled. Here, almost 18 months ago, the Levinson Inquiry into Media Ethics began, and it set off a long process of examining the culture, practices and ethics of the press. Justice Brian Levinson will release his findings tomorrow at 13:30 GMT, to eager anticipation from journalists keen to see how far he will go in recommending legal restrictions on the press. The inquiry was sparked by the phone hacking scandal at the Rupert Murdoch-owned News of the World newspaper, which closed down in the face of public revulsion at the claims of hacking into the phones of celebrities and grieving victims of crime. The Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, Michel Jarreau, says that the Arctic sea ice has melted to its lowest recorded level. The first 10 months of this year were the ninth warmest months since records began in the mid-19th century.
The melting of the ice was much bigger than in previous year. It is the record melting of the Arctic ice. This winter, obviously, the ice will form again, but it will be fresh ice, it will be thin ice, so it's ice which will be more vulnerable to future melting. So definitely the message here is that the trend is not only continuing but accelerating with respect to the melting of the Arctic ice.
And finally, in the United States, detectives who responded to reports of a shooting at a home in Washington state found a floor-to-ceiling stripper pole, 15 marijuana plants, and two angry 5-foot alligators guarding them. The alligators hissed at the detectives when they opened the door. That's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much. I suppose an alligator, well, it replaces a guard dog, doesn't it?
Kind of. I'd never thought of them in that real realm.
I don't think I have either. Not sure they're that easy to get hold of either.
No, quite right. Probably. Bit snappy.
Indeed. It is 6 minutes past the hour and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24.
Oi, London, this is Monaco 24.
Oplondo, tu é Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette er Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda,
London, Europe,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
This is Monaco 24.
And you're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London on Monocle 24. Judges in Egypt's appeal courts have dug in their heels and called a strike after the country's president Mohamed Morsi's recent decree that gave himself new widespread powers. It's issued last week. It's given Mr. Morsi the power to take any measures he needs to stop the revolution. It also says that no court can overturn his decisions. The judges now say the courts will stop all but essential work until the decree is revoked. We've already seen widespread protests against Mr. Morsi's actions. Cairo's Tahrir Square once again has been the focus of much of it. In the last few hours, tear gas has reportedly been fired at protesters. Well, joining me now to discuss the significance of this latest development is Monocle regular Abdul Rahman Hussein, an Egyptian journalist based in Cairo. Good evening to you. First of all, just tell me, what is the latest situation on the ground? Are there more protests? Are these reports of tear gas correct?
They are correct, but we have to bear them in context. Actually, the tear gas hasn't stopped. This has been the clashes between the Ministry of Interior, police forces, and protesters have been going on for over a week now, and they're taking place in a smaller square, very close to Tahrir Square, and they haven't stopped throughout all the protests. All the people come down. This keeps going, and the clashes keep going on. So that's almost kind of a point that. It's always happening, no matter what else is happening in the square. These clashes are always happening.
And I presume no end in sight to them either.
It doesn't look like it, because it's kind of been forgotten in the midst of all that's been happening here, and Morsi's decree and the decision by the Court of Cassation, which is the highest appeals court in the land today, to go on strike.
Yeah, I was getting good point. I mean, about that point itself, how significant is that move, and what kind of a difference is it going to make?
This is actually a very significant move. This was a move that was expected almost immediately after the decree. It took them a while to reach that decision, but basically this is a very important court. It's an integral court to the entire appellate process in Egypt, and their decision to go on strike completely is a big one.
And so what does that mean? I mean, is it going to make Mr. Morsi change his mind or change direction? Or what does it practically mean on the ground?
Well, there have been more developments today, actually. And it doesn't look like Morsi intends to back down at all or rescind the decree. The news that came out after the Cassation Court had announced a strike was that the Constituent Assembly tasked with drafting Egypt's constitution have pretty much finished up their work and are putting it to a vote tomorrow for it to then be put forward in a national referendum. So it appears that Morsi is sort of offering a choice or a way out, in that if you pass the Brotherhood, Muslim Brotherhood dominated constitution, then then the powers will end, because the decree stipulates that he holds these powers, or he keeps these powers, up until a constitution is drafted and parliament is restored.
Okay, so obviously, therefore, as you say, a choice coming up. I mean, the decree itself, some of Morsi's own team were quite surprised by his actions. Are we now seeing sort of where he was coming from? Has this been a sort of big master plan?
If it was a big master plan, it was very ill-advised, and it wasn't really the best way to go about things, because just the initial reaction and the uproar that it has caused, the polarization that it has caused, has been astounding. Even if we are to assume that he had the best intentions at heart, it was still an ill-advised move. You cannot be the first freely elected president of a country that's just gone through revolution, and one of the first things you do is this enormous power grab that gives you, on paper, more power than the dictator Mubarak that you've ousted ever did.
I mean, that's the point. As you say, the country has just been through a revolution. Is the disappointment from ordinary Egyptians that they're sort of in this situation, I suppose, again, that they've had the Arab Spring, there was so much hope after that happened, and now, yet here we are in another fractious situation?
Well, of course there's disappointment and there's outrage, and but it was actually to be expected, because the Muslim Brotherhood, although they did play a big part in the revolution, there are also question marks surrounding their willingness to put their hand in the hands of the ruling military junta, while protesters, Egyptian protesters, were being killed in the streets for over 18 months and up until this moment. And so the hopes and ideals of the revolution don't exactly lie with the Muslim Brotherhood or their president. And I think it was kind of par for the course. Everyone sort of knew that in some way the Muslim Brotherhood would play a big part in Egypt's post-revolution future. The fact that they run the country now was sort of anticipated, but then it hasn't dissuaded people from the fact that if you step in the way of the revolution or its goals or its ideals, we will fight you just like we fought Mubarak.
Okay, Abdulrahman Hussein, Egyptian journalist based in Cairo and a Monocle regular. Thank you very much for joining me. Next, we head to the US, where service women are challenging the US military's policy that bans women from ground combat.
This Christmas, Monocle invite you to Midori House for our first Christmas fair. Mixing up the best of Swedish Yule, Japanese Christmaser, and traditional English Yuletide, we'll be serving up festive cheer at the most elegant Christkindlmarkt in the heart of W1. We'll have live music with a Swedish choir, food by Granger & Co, and our hand-picked retailers can help you with your Christmas shopping. Plus, you can meet a real, live reindeer. So, head to number 1 Dorset Street on the 1st and 2nd of December from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. to meet our Finnish Santa and all his little helpers at the Monocle Christmas Fair.
Christmas is certainly on its way. You're listening to Midori House. Serving your country on the front line is one of the toughest but perhaps most admirable things you can do. And now service women in America are challenging the US military's long-standing policy that bans women from ground combat. 4 US service women who have completed tours in Iraq and Afghanistan have filed a lawsuit against the US Defense Department to try to get the rules changed. Although women in the US are barred from being assigned to combat units, they can be attached to them in order to fill critical gaps since the onset of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But by not being officially assigned, they argue they receive less training and recognition for their service, and it puts them at a disadvantage when they're going for promotion. Well, joining me now to discuss this is military historian and theorist Martin van Creveld. Very good to have you with us, Martin. Well, first of all, what is your thoughts on this case? Do you think these women are going to win?
Since the early 1970s, when women first started moving into the U.S. military in particular, they have won most, if not all, court cases. So I would be very surprised if they don't win this one.
And are the disadvantages that they complain of that I was mentioning about not being given the proper training and the recognition for their service and perhaps the promotion, are those real disadvantages? Is that true, really?
I think there are, because in any army, promotion goes to those who participate in combat most of all. Not exclusively, but most of all. So not being allowed to participate in combat is a real disadvantage, yes?
And so this seems, I suppose, quite a kind of archaic rule. Do you think that it's time that it did change?
Actually, as a man, I don't see why not. Look, for thousands of years, thousands, maybe tens of thousands, men have died in war in order that women may live. I think that it's high time that it would be the other way around. Maybe it's time that women started dying so that men like me should live. I would very much welcome that.
And what about the rules for the US military? Are they similar to other armies in other countries across the world? Is it similar, for example, to the UK army?
Well, in these things, and as in so many others, the United States tends to lead the world. And what becomes reality in the United States today is going to be reality in other places tomorrow. So the answer is probably yes, although there will be some differences between one country and another. But clearly, if this happens, and I think it's very likely to happen, then it will affect other countries as well.
So there are no other countries at the moment where it is more equal?
Well, the most egalitarian countries, militarily, as far as I know at the moment, are the Scandinavian countries. You have female submarine commanders and I don't know what else. But, of course, there's a reason for that. Nobody can remember the last time any Scandinavian country went to war.
So you really think that if these women win their case, which you think is highly likely, this could set a precedent that could change, well, the face of the military across many countries in the world?
Well, you know, the law will change, but I doubt very much whether the practice will change. Let me give you an example from my own country, Israel. The Israeli High Court, in its wisdom, 16 years ago allowed women to volunteer as pilots. But since then, the number who has actually done so has been very small. So small, in fact, that in the hope of satisfying the feminists, the Air Force has been going around begging women, please volunteer for pilot training. As it is now, the Israeli military has about 1,300 combat pilots, and I think no more than 5 or 10 of those are women. So I think it's going to make very little difference, if any, in practice.
Military historian and theorist Martin van Crevel, thank you very much for talking to us. You're listening to Midori House with me, Louise Beale. Tuesday saw the second annual London Policy Conference, hosted by the Demos-affiliated Centre for London. The event saw some of the city's most prominent urbanists and a few inspirational voices from around the globe gathering together to tackle topics from master planning to London's Olympic legacy. The evening's keynote speech came from the American urban theorist and academic Richard Florida. His book, The Creative Class, is now published in a revised version, and his new book, The Great Reset, pushes his theory about a post-industrial economy into the framework of recession recovery. Monocle's David Michon caught up with Florida after his talk.
After the Great Reset, you have this kind of creative class that's come out and it becomes more central. But what's been happening also kind of in London, for example, is also a restriction in the number of people who can come in or out of the country. And likewise, you know, a city like Tel Aviv, which is trying to set up something that's entrepreneurial in tech, is having difficulty, you know, with a kind of national level of government. How do cities, which are the epicenter of this kind of creative class, deal with that kind of separation between national and municipal government?
I think one of the things that we've both worked on, my own work and then Tyler's work and all of the great writing and thinking you guys do at Monocle, is that cities have become the epicenters. Great global cities like London or New York or Shanghai or Hong Kong or San Francisco, the list could go on, and you guys write about them all the time in the magazine. They become the epicenter of this creative age. And it's been going on for the better part of a half century. I mean, of course, it's been going on much longer than that, as cauldrons of artistic creativity and musical creativity. But early on in the 60s, you know, we really saw the death of this old, boring, organization man, bureaucratic society. What happened in London with music, not just with the Beatles and the Stones, with the Who and Hendrix migrating from the United States, and then with the whole punk movement, the New York art scene and creative scene, you know, with Andy Warhol and the Velvet Underground and all of that. And of course, that happened all over the world. And then all of a sudden, we began to realize that cities had this not only creative cultural function, they had this economic function, is that they're the kind of places that attract very ambitious people from around the world. Not just from the little area of the city, they attract people from around the world, and they let anyone, you don't have to be an elitist coming from a great university running the bank. You could be, you know, a street musician, be a rapper like Jay-Z, and cities cultivate and harness that creativity. But what's happened, of course, over the past decade, since I wrote Rise of the Creative Class, is that our cities, London and New York, even as they are epicenters of the creative age, they've given rise to this incredible inequality. As they become more sought after, as the people from around the world have populated these cities, as the global real estate bubble has continued. No one would have believed this, you know, with a crisis. London and New York, the real estate prices would be up again. That's why a lot of my work now is focused on what I call the other 66%. You know, 33% of us have the great good fortune to be knowledge workers or creatives, work in information industries or media industries or technology industries or in management, use our brains at work. There are two-thirds of people in London or New York or in England or the United States or Canada or Northern Europe, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, go on and on. There are two-thirds of people are being left behind. Many of them are not what we think, just a blue-collar worker. Of course, those jobs are being squeezed out. Only about 5% of our workforce actually does real blue-collar work and makes things. But it's the people who work in these service businesses, you know, retail salespeople, people who prepare our food, work in restaurants, hotel people. You know, and Tyler's writing about this all the time. Why don't hotels improve their service? Why doesn't the restaurant have better service? Why don't they act more like Tokyo? I think we have to figure out ways in this new phase of capitalism. I call it a new social compact, to really empower service workers, to pay them better, to engage them in their work intellectually, to create meaning and purpose in their work. That's what I think the big new phase of our economy has to be, empowering this 66% of service workers, engaging them fully, harnessing their creativity, making their work more purposeful and meaningful, and getting them better wages, and letting them participate better in this knowledge economy.
But how do you think, what tools do cities have, you know, if they want to be kind of open, more porous, you know, creative societies, what tools do they have if an international student comes over from the United States or from Singapore to London and isn't allowed to stay after they've completed the degree despite, you know, an ambition to?
Well, countries who kick out talented and creative people because they weren't born there won't make it. I call it the three T's of the creative economy. You have to have technology, duh. You have to have talent, invest in your people, and you have to be tolerant, inclusive. The creative class defies ethnic, national, international, they're global. That's why I find the most innovative places, like the Silicon Valley in its heyday, are the most open. They get creative energy from everywhere. I think so cities, number one, have to remain open and porous. The ones that remain open and porous in a great reset, like now, will do better. The ones that close will kill themselves. The second thing they have to do is promote clustering and concentration. They have to make sure that they're not spreading people out into suburban sprawl. They have to invest in infrastructure. You guys write about this a lot in Monocle. Tyler writes a lot about this. You need state-of-the-art high-speed trains to move people around. You need subway systems and tram systems that work. That's what people want. They don't want to have to drive a car and be stuck in traffic. You have to make sure cities are livable. The housing is affordable. But also the city's not a dirty, filthy, congested, crime-ridden place. It has to be safe. It has to be secure. Our cities need more green space. Creative people need a mix of urban intensity and kind of a natural outlet. And I think most of all, they have to empower their citizens to be creative. You know, I tend to think the most successful cities and societies, we misinterpret this. We think it comes from the big, giant brain coming out of the university. We need a technology transfer program. Many of the great technology brains are dropouts anyway, whether it's Gates or Jobs. But a lot of the creativity that, particularly in the United Kingdom, particularly in England, came from these kids growing up in working class places like John Lennon and Paul McCartney, or Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, or the guys who formed The Clash, or Ozzy Osbourne and his mates in Black Sabbath, or the guys in Led Zeppelin. I once asked your former, one of your chief ministers, about, he was talking about technology transfer in the software industry and making England high tech, and I said, who are the richest people in England? And I was like, well, you know, Paul McCartney and Elton John and Mick Jagger. I said, well, why don't you study what activated your music business? What was it that allowed these working class kids, that activated them to become so successful on a world stage? Their clustering, their concentration, their ability to form a scene. So I think we look too much sometimes at the top-down creativity from a great guru or great intellectual or great scientist, when often it's a combination of top-down and bottom-up. And I think what the best cities do is allow that bottom-up creativity to make it, and to make it and to create whole new ways of hearing music or hearing art or seeing and using technology.
You have a statistic about the percentage of creative class in the United States, which is 33% roughly. But do you think, you know, globally speaking, and this is kind of a classic globalization argument, you know, is it really that the global economy is becoming more of a creative-based economy? Because surely we kind of consume the same number of, you know, material goods which are manufactured. Is it just actually being kind of exported to other places?
We in economic geography have a concept we use for this. We call it the spatial division of labor. So clearly in the advanced economies, we don't make a whole lot of stuff anymore. Just like we don't have a lot of people employed in farming. We may have less than 1% of our population employed in farming, another 5% employed making things. We still make a lot of stuff, but not a lot of people work in it. So we've evolved our economy towards knowledge work or creative work and service work. That said, the world still turns on making a lot of things. So a lot of the development in the world, whether it's China or Mexico, Latin America, the Middle East, is about extending that spatial division of labor. But increasingly, you know, where we're headed is going to be, we're going to automate a lot of that stuff. We're going to make a lot more things with robots. We're going to have a lot less people employed in direct production. It's like when farms were declining as a source of livelihood. There were so many people who bemoaned, what would we do when the family farm is gone? How would we survive when people work in industry? But we became more productive, and manufacturing wages went up, and our GDP went up, and we developed more knowledge and innovation and better universities. Not that it was all great. It was horribly disruptive, and lots of people were displaced, and there were world wars fought over this and great revolutions. Well, now we're moving away from direct production as a principal form of employment to more knowledge-based and creative work and service work. And our task is to build a society which treats people better, more fairly, and I think really gives them meaning and purpose.
That was Richard Florida, urban theorist and academic, speaking to Monocle's David Michon. You're listening to Midori House. Time now for a little bit of music. This is the Pet Shop Boys with West End Girls. That was Pet Shop Boys with West End Girls. In the next half hour on the programme, we look at the reasons for the Left Party's huge success in Latin American countries as we speak to the author and academic Olivier Debain. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. Switzerland and Denmark have today followed France in backing Palestinian calls for a diplomatic upgrade of its UN status to observer state. All members will vote on the issue tomorrow. It's seen as a vital step for Palestine gaining official recognition as an independent state. The Democratic Republic of Congo has today said it was regarding a deal by the rebel group M23 to withdraw from towns captured last week with caution. The M23 said it has started pulling its troops out of towns captured last week from government forces following a deal brokered by Uganda. London's Mayor Boris Johnson, on a visit to India, has stressed the need for boosting trade ties between India and the European Union, saying it was also important for the UK to foster new relationships with other countries. Here, almost 18 months ago, the Leveson Inquiry into Media Ethics began, and it set off a long process of examining the culture, practices and ethics of the press. Justice Brian Leveson will release his findings tomorrow at 13:30 GMT to eager anticipation from journalists, keen to see how far he will go in recommending legal restrictions on the press. The Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization says that the Arctic sea ice has melted to its lowest recorded level. The first 10 months of this year were the ninth warmest months since records began in the mid-19th century. That's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much. This is Midori House on Monocle 24, and we're coming to you live from London. During 1998 and 2012, the left in Latin America won an impressive 24 elections in 13 different countries. From Hugo Chavez to Lula in Brazil, the continent definitely drifted from the previous neoliberal governments. But they also enjoyed impressive economic strength during this period. So what are the merits of the leftist governments in this success? Our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke with Professor Olivier Debain, president of the Political Observatory for Latin America at the Paris Institute of Political Studies, who's just released a new book called, appropriately, The Left in Latin America, 1998 to 2012. Fernando asked how the shift to the left started.
Started in 1908 with Hugo Chavez's first victory, and then it went on, and it's a massive turn to the left, and it covered practically the whole continent, with very few exceptions, such as Mexico, Colombia, but very few exceptions. Even in these countries, the left is governing the capital cities, so it's quite strong too.
And how influential is, I would say he's an iconic figure for the left in the region. How influential is Chavez? Is he still influential?
I don't think he's very influential. I mean, if we look at the left winning elections in the different countries, it has a lot to do with the rejection of the previous era, the neoliberal era, and the economic policies, and doesn't have anything to do with Chavez being a model or Chavez being influential in other campaigns.
It seems to me that there are two types of left in the region, a more moderate one, like in Brazil, and a more radical one, like, for example, Chavez and Evo Morales in Bolivia. Do you agree with that, or do you think they are more or less kind of similar?
I agree if we look at the rhetoric and the programs and the speeches and discourses. At this level, there is definitely a more radical approach in Venezuela, Bolivia. There's a radical left, definitely, and a more moderate one in Brazil or in Argentina, let's say. But what we do in the book is look at the policies, and when we look at what the leftist governments have been actually doing, well, there is not much of a difference. I mean, there are similarities, and we can't really agree with this dual thesis of a radical and a moderate left.
But don't you think there are merits in some of those left governments? Because the economic strength of Latin America overall increased massively during the period that the left was in power. Can you see any correlation?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the left has been lucky in a way. This is why they keep on winning elections. I mean, they won elections at the beginning of the years 2000, and they've been re-elected several times in different countries because of the economic growth and social progresses. I mean, there's massive poverty reduction in Latin America, but the left cannot claim full credit because they've been lucky. I mean, there's an export boom of commodities, and there's a very favorable economic climate in Latin America. So in a way, they've been lucky, but they have taken advantage of that situation to implement social policies, and they've been rather successful.
For example, I think you talk about in your book about the Workers' Party in Brazil, that they kind of kept the same policies as Fernando Henrique Cardoso, you know, including in the social level. But don't you think they were more radical and they really implemented those policies? Because poverty after Lula government, it was almost halved in Brazil.
Definitely, I agree with that. I mean, they built on what Cardoso had done previously. And they went further. I mean, they expanded the approach and the social policies in a new context because the Cardoso had to do the hard work, I mean, of fixing the economy. And then came Lula, and with Lula came a new economic environment in the whole world. And I mean, Cardoso had to deal with a serious economic crisis in 1999, 2000. and nothing comparable for Lula. He's been lucky, so it in a way it was easy for him to expand on the same policies and being more generous, redistributing a lot of money, and as a matter of fact, yes, poverty reduction is very, very impressive in Brazil.
And I just have a question for the future. How do you see the next, 10 or 15 years? Do you think there will be a turn to the right, or do you think the left will remain in power?
Well, as long as there is economic growth and social progress, it's hard to imagine how the left is going to lose elections. I mean, what we've been seeing in Venezuela, for instance, after 14 years in power, Chavez still managed to run a very effective political campaign and be reelected until and is going to be 20 years in power now. And it's hard to imagine how the Workers' Party is going to lose in 2 years from now in Brazil, because there is economic growth and a lot of people are very, very happy with this government. And also because the right in Latin America is having a hard time making proposals, articulating a different programs, basically without any fresh ideas about how to manage the economy. For that reason, I think the left is pretty strong and is going to keep on being strong, unless, of course, there's an economic crisis, but we don't see that coming any time soon.
Maybe the leftist parties in South America, maybe they could teach one thing or two to the left parties here in Europe, don't you think?
Oh, definitely. We had in my university Lula last year making a fabulous speech. It was a lecturing, telling the Europeans how to deal with the economic crisis. I mean, and what we see in Europe is the same policies that were implemented in Latin America 20 years ago. So, yes, there is definitely some lessons to be learned from Latin America.
Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco speaking with Professor Olivia Debain. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this with an update on what we think we already know of what will be in the Levinson Inquiry report to be released on Thursday.
Monocle's third annual soft power survey is an attempt to push the debate on where soft power comes from and how to use it. And with current shifts in the global power balance, never has it been more relevant.
The unofficial yet undisputed leader of Europe relies on the strength of its business brands. While Angela Merkel has been hesitant to do what is necessary to drag the continent out of its economic malaise, Germany has just about enough in its soft power arsenal, from the Goethe Institute to the popularity of its football league, to keep it near the top.
From culture to sport, cuisine to diplomacy, find out which countries are best at wielding their weapons of soft power by watching our countdown in the programmes menu on monocle.com.
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks, and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time, or download the show on Monocle 24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 18:41 here in London. For the press, politicians and public, the Levinson inquiry into media standards in the UK was compelling viewing. At times, it was even compared to a television soap opera or drama. Everyone from David Cameron to Rupert Murdoch were called to give evidence, along with a host of actors and famous names, including Hugh Grant, Max Mosley and J.K. Rowling. Lord Justice Levinson will release his report on Thursday, but already there's widespread speculation on what it will say and what, if any, regulation the government will bring in as a result result of his findings. The Prime Minister says he'll seek a cross-party consensus on regulation, but has told MPs the status quo, where the press regulates itself, is unacceptable and needs to change. John Rentoul is chief political commentator for The Independent on Sunday and joins me now. John, thank you very much for joining me. The Levinson report, well, it's widely expected to recommend some form of statutory regulation overseen by an independent body. Do you think that's the most likely outcome? Because obviously everyone's talking about it already and we haven't actually read it yet.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. It is, it's hopeless to speculate, really. That does seem to be the most likely outcome. But I mean, it's perfectly possible, because that is vehemently opposed by an awful lot of the press and an awful lot of politicians, on the grounds that you don't want the state interfering in what people are allowed to publish. So it may be that Lord Justice Leveson will take that strength feeling into account and come to some kind of compromise.
Obviously, for David Cameron, this is a pretty tricky moment, because, I mean, the inquiry was, 18 months long from start to finish. A lot of work has gone into it. He needs to be seen to be acting on it in some way. I know that he has apparently sort of cleared his diary to read through it. He has a copy of it already. But what do you think's going through his mind at the moment?
I think it's probably like a sort of homework nightmare, isn't it? A sort of essay crisis for the student. He has to read. It's supposed to be something like 2,000 pages.
Crikey!
And he's got to, he's got to have something sensible to say about it by 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, which is, that's one hell of a deadline.
And also, I suppose, not just having something sensible to say, he's got to talk to his coalition partners, to the Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg, and they've got to come up with, well, I suppose the aim is to come up with a cohesive sort of reaction from the two of them. But there is sort of speculation that this could cause a possible split in the coalition, isn't there? Because they may have quite different views.
Right. I mean, it is rumoured. Well, it is. We know that Nick Clegg has actually sounded out the Speaker of the House of Commons about the possibility of giving a separate statement himself in response to the Leveson report. That he did, obviously, before he'd seen the report. So he was obviously anticipating the possibility that he and David Cameron might come to different conclusions about it. The latest I've seen is that Nick Clegg and David Cameron are meeting now, as we speak, to discuss their first impressions of what the report actually says.
We've also seen today, I think it's around 80 cross-party MPs and peers and other people, including Lord Coe, who was obviously chairman of LOCOG that put on the London Olympics. They've written to the Prime Minister saying that they mustn't bring in press regulation or a law, sorry. So obviously, I mean, there is a strength of feeling out there that the press shouldn't be regulated.
Well, no, there's very strong feeling on both sides, because, it's one of these issues where you've had, huge lists of people, MPs in particular, on both sides, writing to the papers that there must be statutory regulation of the press, or that there must not be. And tomorrow is the deciding moment.
And as you say, that
he has to come to a decision on this very quickly, and he's got to get it right. I mean, that's why it's seen as such a challenge to him.
What do you think about public reaction? Because obviously for those of us who work in the media, and for politicians, and obviously those celebrities I talked about, but also obviously the people who've been real victims of journalists, I suppose we're talking about Millie Dowler's parents, the schoolgirl that was murdered and her phone was allegedly hacked into. But what do you think the general rest of the public concern is? Is this something that actually they're going to be bothered about, or is this something that we're perhaps all getting in a bit of a flap about?
Well, it certainly is a media story, and we journalists love media stories. But it is also a story that people generally feel very strongly about. The problem is that people tend to take very simplistic positions on this. I mean, journalists tend to say that the state shouldn't regulate the press, but actually the Parliament has laid down legislation by which there are regulators that regulate broadcasting, for example. So, and nobody bats an eyelid about that. And you ask most people in the street what they think. They think the press is disgraceful, but they they still pay good money to read the salacious stories that it contains.
Exactly, because that's the thing. I mean, you know, the News of the World, the newspaper that was shut down, had an enormous readership, and probably a lot of people felt perhaps a bit sort of bereft after it had gone. But I suppose you can't have it both ways, can you?
That's right. I mean, and, you know, I mean, I was perhaps making a slightly cheap point there because, I mean, although people did want to read the salacious stories, they didn't know how some of these stories had been obtained. And if they had known, they would have been, well, and they now are, extremely disapproving. I mean, but that leads us to another problem that David Cameron faces tomorrow, which is that actually the cases that we care most about, the Millie Dowlers and the Madeleine McCann, cases are mostly covered by the existing law. I mean, a lot of the things that journalists did in both those cases that we disapprove of very strongly are actually illegal. And so the question is, how do you enforce the existing law rather than, you know, should you be appointing new regulators to enforce new regulations?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it already was an existing law, as you say. I mean, this is probably an impossible question to ask you, but do you think sort of whatever happens, whatever Leveson says, something is going to change, or that there must be some sort of step change because we've had such an enormous inquiry and so much money spent on it? Do you think...
Call me cynical, but no. I think that an awful lot of what has happened is, you know, what happens when you have a free press. There have plainly been failures of the way that the law has been enforced or not enforced. The police seem to have known about the Millie Dowler phone hacking for a long time before anybody else found out about it, and obviously regarded it as normal journalistic practice. You know, so perhaps some attitudes will change, and there'll be some institutional changes. There'll no doubt be, you know, a new press complaints commission. It'll be called something else, but it'll essentially do the same thing. And it might be, it might have its powers laid down in statute, but it will essentially do the same thing that the existing press complaints commission does. And we'll bumble on into the future quite happily.
Okay. Well, I'm sceptical, but John Rentoul, chief political commentator for The Independent on Sunday, thank you very much indeed. We will have to wait and see when it is released tomorrow. Now, before we try to find out why the French are drinking less wine than ever before, let's have some music from the country in question. This is Cherry Blossom Girl by Air. That was Cherry Blossom Girl by Air. You're listening to Midori House with me, Louise Beale. Now, rather surprising news from France. Despite having the reputation of being one of the biggest wine countries, the French drink now less wine than ever before. An average adult consumes the equivalent of barely a glass a day. So what is the world coming to? Well, to give us her view on this, we have Catherine Nicholson, journalist based in Paris, on the phone. Good evening to you, Catherine.
Hi there, Louise. Hello.
Hello. So, I mean, gosh, this is very surprising. What is the world coming to? Is this true?
I know. Next, we'll have a survey that says that the French aren't eating cheese anymore. I mean, it's the world turned upside down. Well, these official figures are from the Agriculture Ministry, and it is quite a massive reduction over the last 50 years or so. They say that in 2010, the average adult had about 57 litres of wine a year. In 1965, it was about 160. It sounds to me more like they've gone from utterly ridiculous consumption levels to something that's quite normal. But yes, there's several factors behind this. I mean, obviously, France is going through an economic crisis as much as the rest of Europe. So lots of different things. People aren't running around the streets panicking as yet.
No. I mean, because this is the point, as a British person, I always think of France in a very sort of romantic fashion, I suppose, that everyone's having a glass of wine at lunchtime and a couple in the evening. And I'm sure when I've been to Paris, that's, and other places in France, that's what happens. But it's probably because I'm on holiday. But is that culture, is that just not true, or is that still going?
No, that, I think that culture does still exist. I think it's just that traditions are changing a little bit. I actually did some rather non-scientific research of my own and asked around a couple of the local bars and a couple of friends who own bars. And they say that it is true that, say, lunchtime drinking isn't such a big thing as it used to be. Most French people will still have a proper meal at lunchtime, very old-fashioned, your granny would approve. But it used to be the case that they would definitely have at least one glass of wine with lunch. But people I've spoken to who own bars say, you know, nowadays, if they have 100 people in for lunch, maybe 5 or 10 of them will have wine with their lunch. People, you know, perhaps worried about drink driving or just the general health issues that everybody's quite up on nowadays. And of course, the French are quite healthy and they're all stick thin and it's just all a shame.
I was going to say, I mean, you mentioned earlier about the recession and obviously that may be playing a part in this. Are there other reasons behind it? Is it fashionable? I think you were mentioning that perhaps it's because there's now a fashion to drink beer.
Yes, that's true. I think a lot like in the UK, where there's a lot of little sort of minority beers, small breweries, ciders and things. Not so much maybe with the ciders over here, but definitely with the beers. The Belgians just next door definitely got in on that with the kind of trendy beer market. And you're seeing a lot more bars selling a lot more different kinds of beers nowadays, definitely. So I think when you go out in Paris, people aren't drinking as much wine because, I mean, mojitos are massive here still, and they have been for about 5 years, but also the beers and that kind of thing. And also I think wine is seen as something that's quite traditional. People might drink wine more at home than they would when they're sort of going out on a night out, where they might try something that's a little bit trendier. But like you said, the economic aspect definitely comes into it as well. I think looking at the figures, France isn't actually as badly off as the UK economically, but people are much more aware of it for some reason. We talk about it a lot more in France, and I think people have more consciously reined in their purchases. And bar owners I spoke to saying that people are probably drinking as much wine when they go out, but drinking cheaper ones, so they've traded down a little bit.
And what about the health sort of aspects of things? Because, I mean, certainly there's legislation going on in the UK, I mean, even today, talking about minimum pricing of alcohol. Is there a sort of push to perhaps get people to drink less because it's healthier?
You know, it's funny because the French, they on adverts for food on the TV, there's always a little message at the bottom, which I think is a legal requirement, that says, remember to keep moving around, exercise as well as eating, vary your diet, don't have just fatty, salty things. But in terms of alcohol, people, it's not such a massive thing in people's minds. I think the binge drinking culture is only actually starting to creep in, and probably only in the bigger cities like Paris. I've seen a few reports on the TV about that in the last couple of years, with people saying, oh, what's this binge drinking thing that young people are doing? That's very antisocial of them. It's not very elegant. But I think whereas in the UK people are worried about binge drinking and people sort of getting up in the morning and having a drink first thing, that's just not the culture in France at all. Obviously, there will be alcoholics around, but, you know, in terms of people getting absolutely wasted on a Friday and Saturday night, it's just not so much the culture. And even young people in their 20s kind of look down on that a little bit.
And what about, I mean, this is probably a cheeky question, but what about you? You're living in Paris. Are you consciously drinking less wine, or have you, since living there, been enjoying it?
Oh, I probably drink more wine since living here, actually. In fact, I had a very, sort of a half and half French-British dinner size of lamb curry, which isn't French at all, with a nice glass of Bordeaux. So I think I maybe had this interview on my mind. but it is, I mean, the thing about being in France is that you can treat yourself to an absolutely delicious, lovely, high-class bottle of wine that costs absolute pennies.
Yeah.
Whereas in the UK, it's a lot more expensive. So we are treated, and maybe because it's so freely available, people are just like, oh, you know, I could have wine any time. I won't get crazy. I'm not sure if there's anything too scientific about it.
I think I'm going to jump on the Eurostar and come over for a glass of wine. Catherine Nicholson, journalist based in Paris, thank you very much for joining me. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. Thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippie, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Up next after the news is The Entrepreneurs, where Sophie Grove is heading to catastrophe. And in 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours time here in London, Andrew Miller and Dominic Reynolds will be back for the Monocle Daily. Midori House will be back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.